This next panel is raising capital for MLPs, both from the capital markets and bank financing perspectives. My name is Jeremy Barnes. I'm a principal with EY, formerly known as Ernst & Young. Some of you may still know us as Ernst & Young. I'm based here in New York. I'm a principal focused on energy transactions, M&A due diligence. This is my fastball. And while I know enough to know that high splits is not necessarily something that my daughter does at gym class, we do have more knowledgeable resources at EY. Greg Matlock is one, and you may have seen him speak in one of the panels earlier today. With that, I'll just ask the panel quickly to introduce themselves, and we'll get into the agenda here.
Hello, I'm Frank Murphy, Managing Director at Robert W. Baird & Company, and I've been active in the MLP market for 20 or so years, and glad to be here today.
Javier Artola, I'm an Executive Director at UBS Investment Bank. I focus on midstream and MLPs, and I've been in investment banking for about 10 years.
Bill Cooper, I'm a partner in the Corporate Securities Group at the law firm Andrews Kurth Kenyon, and work both in capital markets and M&A with a focus on energy, and then even within energy, a focus on MLPs.
My name is Jay Hatfield. I started out my career at Morgan Stanley as an investment banker and worked on MLPs there. And I'm also a board observer and general partner of NGL Energy Partners, and also the CEO and co-founder of InfraCap Advisors, and we manage InfraCap MLP Fund, AMZA, and PFFR, which is our REIT preferred fund.
Thanks very much. And Jay, you're double dipping on this panel, and
yes,
you've moved to the end just to make
sure
we're all still awake.
I saved the really fascinating stuff for this panel.
So just to get us kicked off then, we've heard a lot of about the macro and micro factors that are impacting the sector, particularly regulatory change, potential of tax reform, rising interest rates, volatility in energy markets in general. What do you see as the primary drivers for influencing capital raising in MLP space?
I'll start first. I think the principal driver these days is clearly the interest rate environment, but it goes down to the actual MLP itself and where it's positioned in the energy value chain and its growth outlook and so forth, and in turn its cost of capital. So that's at the moment a primary driver from the issuer standpoint. From the other side of the equation is the availability of capital at the funds. And we heard the prior panel talk about the amount of money coming into the sector has been growing in the last few quarters, and that's certainly helping the environment from that standpoint. So,
yeah, I mean, I would echo some of that. I think the recent rally is definitely driven by, in big part, I think, by tax reform and more favorable regulatory environment. I think interest rates will be tricky, whether in terms of timing of the interest rate escalation and the magnitude. If the Fed really raises rates too fast or too soon, I think that could be a challenge not just for MLPs but for the market as a whole. If they do it too late, then that could lead into asset bubbles and some other issues. So I think that's more of a consequence rather than a challenge. But really, the tailwind that we're seeing, I think, is really in midstream and in MLPs is really the potential for more favorable regulatory environment.
One thing I'll mention on the legal front, although it's we've heard this panel and the prior panels kind of a more positive market outlook. Generally, the IPO pipeline is still a little constrained. I think that's part kind of people are looking for quality issues, and there are only so many out there in the midstream space. We're also having conversations with people about tax reform and the potential what tax reform is going to do. The tax panel this morning talked about, is there a chance that corporate rates come down so far that doesn't really make sense to be in the MLP pass-through structure anymore. I guess that's a possibility. And one thing that people are considering, and it's actually in one of the ones that's in registration, that's public, Hess now, has put in some language in the partnership agreement that would allow the general partner to determine if there is tax legislation that it makes more sense to convert to a C-Corp, then they can go ahead and do that without unit holder approval. And it's very broad language to try to give them maximum flexibility. I think the purpose of that is really kind of to deflect questions on the roadshow. What are you guys going to do with tax reform? But it's out there. It could be one of the bells and whistles that end up in MLP agreements that are very rarely used. But I think you'll probably see that sort of thing in most of the new issues.
One point that I make that wasn't made in the last panel, and in connection with interest rates, is that actually MLPs, from a theoretical standpoint, are still dramatically undervalued. Nowhere nearly as much as last time we did this panel in last February, where they were just sort of insanely valued. And I think I might have said they were the big long, which they are clearly not the big long now after being up about 100% from them. But they should, in this interest rate environment, trade south of 5% yields, and the group on an equal weighted basis is north of 7. So that would imply upwards of 50% upside. So even without tremendous regulatory tailwinds, I still see the sector grinding higher over the next 3 years and being, you know, continuing to have very high returns relative to at least historical returns for the stock market. So we're bullish from that interest rate perspective. And I guess the last thing I'd say about that is that we still think the beta of MLPs is mostly driven by energy prices. Although I will say, I think for the first time that I've seen in like 2 or 3 years, MLPs were up a couple days ago when interest rate sectors were rallying and energy was down and energy stocks were down. But that, you know, may be the new trend, but it's not fully in place yet.
Thank you. The hot topic that we've already heard discussed in a couple of panels today, obviously, is around simplification transactions, reducing IDRs, resetting IDRs, buying out the public float at the MLP. Do you see this trend continuing? And if so, why? And how will that impact capital raising?
Well, simple answer is yes. The trend continues. It's sort of the natural life cycle of many of the MLPs. I think it's been accelerated somewhat by, you know, volatility in the sector and cost of capital issues that have faced some of the larger MLPs. So we've seen some high-profile simplification and GP buybacks. But as a course, as a matter of course, every MLP eventually will face the need to redo its GP, either buy it back or eliminate the IDRs and so forth. So I think that trend continues. One thing to keep an eye on that could cause some acceleration would be if in the course of tax reform, the concept of the carried interest tax raises its head again, as it did back several years ago, and that triggered a flurry of GP IDR restructurings. That was the last cycle that we did it. But yes, the trend continues.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think especially as more MLPs have eliminated their IDRs and improved their cost of capital, from a competitive standpoint, that is more likely than other MLPs will follow. I think in terms of, so that's in terms of IDR elimination. Then the question really becomes, do you maintain two public currencies or do you go to a C-Corp structure? And I think that's really case by case. And I would say all else equal, if corporate rates are reduced, like I said, all else equal, the tax advantage of the MLP structure is diminished. So it'll be interesting to see how, and there's other strong arguments like liquidity, access to a broader investor universe that other panelists before have made, which are very compelling. And now we have some case studies of securities that really evidence maybe a slight premium in terms of valuation on a C-Corp currency versus an MLP. So I think all those things will continue to play out, but I don't think that this trend is one that's going to be reversed.
Yeah, I think we're getting lots of calls on simplifications, probably more on those than on IPOs these days. And lots of things can be called a simplification. There are some, like ETP SXL, where it's just simplifying the corporate structure, but the IDRs are going to stay out. The DCP transaction was kind of similar. It was essentially just a large drop down. They're consolidating the business in the MLP, but the IDRs are staying out. But also lots of questions on cost of capital and what do we do about that. And you can have the traditional roll-up. You'll go up to the C-Corp structure. You can do it the opposite way, which you've seen occasionally in the past, probably not something you'll see this year, where the MLP buys out the GP and can eliminate the IDRs as part of that transaction. And then just an IDR buy-down, where both entities would stay out, but buy down the IDRs. And that's got some execution advantages that you don't have to go out to unit holders. Just you can have the conflicts committee of the MLP can approve that transaction.
I guess I have a little bit of a different view in terms of the drivers of IDR restructuring and GP restructuring. I mean, clearly, if you're in a distressed market, the IDR structure makes your cost of capital too high, but really the cost of capital is too high for any security, really. But what was driving a lot of the consolidations was really, in effect, an unfair allocation of risk between the GP and the LP, because the GP was supposed to take more risk, and then, of course, if they cut the distribution at the LP, then the GP loses all the distribution. And so, like a good example of KMI, they consolidated everything, eliminated the IDRs, and then cut the distribution 80%. Well, if they'd done that before, then they would have no distribution at KMI. So a lot of it was just a driven by the GPs and an unfair allocation of risk between the GPs and the LP. And partly that also was driven by leverage at the GP, which is extremely imprudent because you have, in effect, an option that you're levering. Whereas, like, our GP for NGL Energy Partners is unlevered, and we took a distribution cut, and we went to zero, and then the LP went to half. So if we had consolidated first and then done that, it would have been unfair to the LP holders. So I don't see it necessarily just cost of capital, because if we do grind down closer to 5%, and you have 50% ups on the IDR, that's 10, which is not impossible to find projects where you get 10% return on equity. So I'm not saying they won't happen, but I think it's as driven by potentially disadvantaging the LP versus the GP and also dealing with leverage at the GP level as much as cost of capital.
And while we're on cost of capital, which obviously is an important topic, you've all touched on how the buying back the MLP or cutting the IDR helps with that. Are there any other levers that we haven't talked about in terms of being able to reduce cost of capital?
Well, clearly the IDRs are one. I think the good old performance and growth is the best one. I mean, there's sort of a split market at the moment, with some of the MLPs having a fairly high cost of capital, and they tend to be the ones that came into the downturn in either, you know, basins that saw a sharp reduction in activity, or with balance sheets that were over-levered, and they're really challenged in terms of their ability to reduce their cost of capital. It's just to grind it out, get the debt paid down, and hope for a recovery, which we're starting to see in some of the basins. But the core lever that they have is essentially, reduce the IDRs to the extent that's a factor, and then ultimately potentially look for consolidation into a stronger partner to try and reduce the capital that way.
Yeah, I mean, especially I'd say this time last year, improving the balance sheet and shoring up liquidity was a way to not only reduce cost of capital, but also improve reduce the risk of the business model.
I'd agree. In addition to getting rid of the IDRs, if you've got a MLP family where someone's got a higher cost of capital, it maybe doesn't make sense to leave that out as a separate MLP and consolidate.
Yeah, I'll just echo emphasize Frank's comment that I think a lot of the deleveraging and financial engineering might be behind us, and that it's going to really come down to performance. delivering performance, and also just passage of time so investors calm down and we grind closer to that 5% fair value for MLPs from the current 7%.
Switching gears a little bit, in terms of investor mix on MLPs, traditionally it's been weighted obviously more heavily towards retail versus institutional and domestic versus foreign because of the tax benefits. With the prospect of tax reform out there, have you seen any changes in the mix, and what are the trends and what's driving it?
Well, I think it's a little early to detect any big changes to the mix, but there's clearly been over the last, you know, as we went into the downturn, there had been a demonstrable shift to institutional investment in MLPs. And institutions meaning essentially the MLP closed-end funds and the ETFs and so forth, which is largely retail money that's been consolidated, but it's we consider it institutional. Many of the IPOs that were occurring pre-downturn, you know, we were seeing 70-80% institutional and 20%, 30% retail, which was quite a change from 5 years earlier, 10 years earlier, when it was, you know, the opposite, 90% retail and so forth. So at this stage, I think tax reform, we're seeing the retail investors starting to come back. It's not a groundswell, but there's some renewed investor interest, especially in the last few months since the election. But it's still, in terms of the capital markets, still predominantly driven by the MLP funds and the institutions.
I would say during the downturn, I think the retail investor sort of fled the space. And more recently, over the past few months, we've seen a comeback. UBS has a, and this may sound like a self-serving comment, but UBS has a very strong retail platform. We leverage our retail investors in during every offering we do, and it helps improves the execution and add some price competitiveness. I think institutions still drive pricing and most of the demand. But I think we're back to like 20 to 30% kind of 2015 levels in terms of retail percentage retail distribution. We're also seeing more interest in securities like perpetual retail preferreds that have been out for a while. Neustart did one late last year. A lot of companies are asking us about it. It's again, partially a reflection of that retail demand coming back.
We're certainly hearing the same thing from the companies and banks that we work with, that much smaller retail component investor base than previously. The only caveat is still, if you have a transaction that requires unitholder approval, that's something to take into consideration. You still have, there are enough retail holders out there that that's still a little bit of a burden.
I think it's the most important thing is not so much retail versus institutional like in equity deals, but trying to create more fundamental demand. As I mentioned earlier, even though they're institutions, they're just driven by retail investors. So if we do get tax reform and there's more movement toward corporations and more equity going into pension funds, there really isn't any major pension fund allocations to MLPs, which I think is a mistake. The only one I'm aware of is in Oklahoma. So I think that's going to be a long-term trend, but it's going to be slow. So for now, the sector is likely to be more volatile because it's ultimately driven by retail demand.
More generally, what's driving the large disparity in pricing across the MLP asset class? There are obvious ones like upstream versus midstream. Upstream ones obviously got hammered. Additionally, for example, the threat of counterparty risk after the Sabine case, is there still an overhang from that? What are the factors that you look for that really depress prices versus give others a boost?
Well, I think and I look at the MLP market in sort of two categories. There's the investment grade, the large MLPs, and there within that category, I think it was a combination of balance sheet strength, position, i.e. financial risk of the entity, weighed against what were their growth prospects and so forth. So there's a there's a differentiation, you know, clearly between the overlevered large cap MLPs and the solid names who have conservative balance sheets. In the smaller end, the small and mid-sized MLPs, it's balance sheet's an important consideration. Clearly, if you're overlevered, you're sort of in the penalty box and your cost of capital is high. But once you get beyond that, the primary correlation to valuation and cost of capital is growth. And, you know, are you in an area, do you have the ability to fund growth, and are you in an area that is growing? And so investors can see visible growth for the next few years.
Yeah, I mean, I would say cash flow stability continues to be one of the most important aspects of differentiating valuations amongst MLPs. I think during the downturn, there was definitely a very strong flight to quality. I think now the growth discussion is coming back, where you're starting to again see a correlation between expected distribution growth and yield over a strong correlation between expected distribution growth and yield in the MLP universe. I would say those two are probably the biggest differentiator factors are cash flow stability and growth.
We're certainly hearing the same thing that, you know, in addition to kind of high quality assets, having the sponsor up there that's got a visible pipeline of drop down assets for growth purposes is that's the most attractive, you know, for both existing MLPs and also IPOs, potential IPOs.
I just looked at our valuation matrix for the large cap companies that are in the index we track, and it's actually surprisingly fairly valued. So the gaps are limited to 10%. So we have models that look at risk, including leverage, and then growth, and then multiples to distributable cash flow. And so that's actually converged, whereas during the downturn, companies often, like Magellan, EPD, the high-quality companies were massively overvalued because everybody was buying them, and the riskier companies were 30, 40, 60% undervalued. So the large cap group has converged. And I would argue, to the extent there's a valuation gap between the large cap companies and the small cap companies, that's appropriate. Because a lot of times those are not investable companies. They could be sand companies, shipping companies, refiners. So there's almost no valuation that I would want to go and purchase those companies.
Sticking with pricing just for a second, how do we see in terms of trends the GPs trading, public GPs versus the MLPs? For a time there was a disparity in trading multiples. Has that normalized yet, or do we see trends going forward there as well?
Well, there's a spectrum, and it's driven in part by the underlying MLP. It's whether it's growing its distribution or not, whether it's covering its distribution, i.e. earning enough money to cover the distribution. And so we've seen, you know, no growth or slow growth MLPs where that have a public GP, there's a handful of those, where the public GP is trading very close in terms of yield to the underlying MLP. Then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got some high growth, and here we see people like Equitable, Tallgrass, where they've got significant growth, and they'll be trading, you know, the GP will generally trade a couple hundred basis points below the MLP, and the MLP is already trading at a fairly low yield because of the growth rate. So clearly driven by growth and coverage on the underlying entity.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the GP-MLP valuation relationship, with the exception of a handful, is pretty much broken. I think that as GPs have either undertaken IDR restructurings or have cut their distribution or under a lower distribution growth rate, you've seen that valuation where GPs used to trade at a 200 to 300 basis points premium to the underlying MLP kind of go away. May there are still some exceptions to that. You mentioned Tallgrass, EQT, I think are probably two that still maintain that GP-MLP relationship, mainly driven just by the fact that the underlying MLP is still growing and very, very well, very, very functional, and the GP security just becomes a very clear read-through levered investment to the underlying MLP. But other than a handful of those, I think that valuation relationship has disappeared, at least from a yield standpoint.
I would just add, sorry, that
nothing to add.
The best way to look at the GP valuation is to disaggregate the valuation of the LPs, because most public GPs hold LPs and have the IDRs. And so our models split that out, so you can look at the multiple of IDR cash flow. And those actually got to insane levels because investors weren't properly correcting for the fact you're paying for a mixture of GPs and LP. So you would see multiples like 50, 60, 70 times on the IDR cash flow. And I just looked at our sheet, which I have with me, and you know the multiples are now what you would expect them to be, which are in the kind of 15 to 20 times, you know, so that implies like a 5, 6, 7% yield, which is reasonable, and you could see growing out of that. Whereas if you're trading, like WGP was trading at like 100 times IDR cash flow. So if you start with a 1% yield, you better have phenomenal growth to get to a reasonable yield quickly. So this dislocation has kind of actually brought rationality into the GP valuation market.
If I can follow up something that Javier mentioned around distribution cuts. I mean, back in the day, first of all, there were no distribution cuts, right? But if it happened, that would be a bad signal. In the last couple of years, we've seen a couple of instances where we've had cuts, and then the price actually had a spike after that. Are those days over? Do you think we'll see any more of those, or is it back to normality now?
Yeah. So I think I think it really matters. The context here really matters. If it is a distribution cut that the market's already expecting, then the market reaction really depends on whether the cut was maybe bigger or lower than your average marginal investor was expecting. If that cut back in the downturn was to, again, shore up liquidity and strengthen balance sheet and just strengthen the viability of the MLP, those were generally either anticipated or positively viewed by the market. If it is a cut in the context of a broader transaction like an IDR restructuring or an elimination, I think those that have substantial benefits to MLP holders and to other investors, then I think, again, those are welcomed. If it is just a cut for the sake of cutting or just changing the MLP for no particular reason, I think that's where MLP investors in MLPs are still yield-seeking investors. So it is important for for them and for the market to continue to maintain that distribution. And there's an underlying, I think, understanding that that's going to be the case, and that any cut is really more an exception rather than a trend.
Oh, I'll say the good news is we're not feeling nearly the same level of calls about people asking about cutting or our peers are cutting. What do we do?
Well, that's one reason we run our models on distributable cash flow and not yield. So during the downturn, people were completely irrational. So they didn't. If there was going to be a cut, they just didn't want to own the stock at any price. And so that's why you can, when you have a cut, you can have people positively react because when they see the actual cut, they realize it's not that bad. There's probably one company out there, Enbridge, has announced that they're basically reviewing what level cut they might need to do. But other than that, most of our models show good, or all of our models, with that exception, show good coverage, good growth, and that the large cap companies have dealt with their problems.
Maybe one for Bill. From a legal perspective, what obstacles do we see out there that may affect financing and deal structuring currently?
We still have all the customary issues. You know, and as the market improves, maybe not as big of a hindrance in transactions as you did in a more distressed environment, like change of control puts in bonds and debt instruments, which was really holding up some transactions and forcing people into bankruptcy. For these roll-ups, you are going to need unit holder approval. So going out to market will take a while to get them completed. And even if you just do an IDR buyback, that's going to have to go through the conflicts committee. So management's got to think about the timeline. And as we mentioned earlier, the tax reform uncertainty. So, you know, depending on what happens there, does that really have an impact on the sector in terms of whether people want to come out as MLPs and even the existing MLPs, whether they want to restructure either through a roll-up or all sorts of other things we've talked to people about. You could merely check the box and you become an MLP that's taxed as a corporation like Plains GP. That simple. That would still, for an existing MLP, you'd still have to go out to unit holders to get that approval. You could do a conversion or a little merger with an affiliate to go to a C-Corp if you want it to be C-Corp entity structure. Another interesting thing that we've talked to a couple people about, we'll see, kind of complicated, but could you go into an Up-C structure where you basically give MLP unit holders the ability to elect, do I want to go into a C-Corp parent or I stay at the MLP? And you've got unit holders at two entities. That's the complexity. But in terms of fairness, you allow people to stay if they want to stay and or convert if they want to convert. And I know early this morning we heard some people that were not in favor of sort of first forced conversion and taking the tax hit. Although those transactions can be structured as taxable or non-taxable. Most of the time the sponsor is going to want it to be taxable to get the step up, but for whatever reason they decide they don't want to do it, it could be structured as non-taxable. I'm told by my tax team, I'm not a tax lawyer.
Great, thanks. We wanted to leave a couple minutes for questions from the floor. Does anyone have any questions? Is there one over here?
This is for Jay. You were mentioning the 5 versus the 7. Where's the 5 come from?
5 is a conservative estimate of BBB bond yields. So it's really like 4.6, but I just rounded up because maybe rates are going to trend higher. But in other words, treasuries are low and bond spreads are low. And if you look at a chart, shockingly, MLPs shockingly track BBBs almost right on top for years and years and years. In fact, even in 07, 08, only 1 month did they gap out by like 200 or 300 basis points. So you'd say, oh my God, it was terrible in 07, 08 because yields were 13. Well, BBB bonds were yielding 12.5. So, and then 1 month MLPs spiked up. But then the next month they came back down. So the correlation was nearly 100%. Until the oil went from 100 to 20.
Any other questions? Maybe if there are no further questions, I'll ask one more. We haven't really touched on bank lending. How do you see that progressing?
Javier, I don't lend, so I'll let you.
I think. I'm trying to think what's my firm stand on this one, but that lending, bank lending in the energy sector has continued to grow over the past several years. Last year, a lot of banks, especially with high exposure to some of the larger commercial banks with exposure to energy names, were certainly examining their loan books. I think. It was beneficial that this happened while the rest of the economy was still strong and growing, unlike it happened in the real estate sector in 2008. I think right now there's probably a divergence between commercial banks and investment banks, and in particular between the European banks and U.S. banks, with both U.S. and commercial banks just lending a lot more to the sector than pure investment banks or European banks.
I guess just anecdotally, and I can say things since I don't know, I'm not affiliated with a bank, but anecdotally, I think there was some regulatory pressure on banks to cut back on their energy exposure, and that might have been irrational Dodd-Frank sort of after-the-fact regulation, so it remains to be seen whether that will be rolled back, but certainly I was hearing from companies that just harder to get people into bank groups, foreign banks, like I don't think there's anybody on this panel, but like Deutsche Bank obviously is cutting back on exposure, and that's not to say it's not possible to get deals done, but just a little bit harder because of regulatory constraints.
Yeah.
One thing I'll mention, not bank lending, but just on the capital markets topic, is that the rise in all the preferred issuances we're seeing in the MLP space, and maybe they originated in a little bit of a distressed environment, but now you're seeing perfectly healthy MLPs will go out and raise preferred, and it's a way to, I mean, the infrastructure funds almost have unlimited checkbooks, and $1 billion, and it's a way, because that's a little high for a follow-on offering for somebody still MLP structure, so you could do preferred in lieu of a follow-on, you could do preferred with a follow-on, which is what Dominion did recently, and the MLPs can bring in the funds and basically, you know, run an auction. Who's going to give me the best terms?
Yeah, I think under that context, bank lending, direct bank lending, is probably a little less, I would say, less important. If you have very strong high-yield markets, which we have right now, you have a very strong preferred market, whether it's a private market or a public preferred market, and equity markets trading at all-time highs, then that usually tends to be a preferred route for companies to raise capital to fund projects and fund other CapEx needs.
Thank you. I certainly want to thank the panel for these comments, and thank you all for listening.